Chemical Watch podcast.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch, intelligence to transform product safety.
Hello, this is Kate Lowe, Global Managing Editor of Chemical Watch, welcoming you to this week's news podcast hosted by members of the Chemical Watch team. For today's episode, I'm joined from Washington, D.C. by North America Managing Editor Terry Hyland, from Brussels by Europe reporter Catherine Carlson, and from the UK by Science Editor Andrew Turley. On the agenda today is a hazard-based study carried out by scientists in Germany and Norway who say they have found that bioplastics and plant-based materials on the market are just as toxic as conventional plastics with regards to the chemicals they contain. We will also be taking a look at a legal challenge that has been launched against ECHO by the company at the centre of two landmark cases on animal testing of cosmetic ingredients. The company is Symrise. And finally, we'll be catching up with the latest developments in the US, where the transition team for the incoming president and vice president has announced the formation of a 12-member group tasked with evaluating the EPA's operations before the new administration takes over on the 20th of January. But let's start with the latest study into bioplastics and plant-based materials on the market by scientists in Germany and Norway. Governments around the world are increasingly taking steps to reduce use of plastics in response to concerns about environmental pollution and consumption of non-renewable resources. Discussion of such steps sometimes involves specific consideration of bioplastics, a term that can include both biodegradable materials and bio-based materials, which are produced from renewable raw materials such as plants. Now, whether a plastic is bio-based or not, it has chemical and physical properties that influence its safety, and suppliers must comply with relevant regulations. In Europe, for example, bioplastic products intended for use as food contact materials have to comply with two specific regulations, while those manufactured from regenerated cellulose are regulated under separate legislation. So, Andrew, can you just start by telling us more about this latest study into the safety of bioplastics and plant-based materials on the market? What exactly did the scientists test and how?
Hi, Kate. The scientists used in vitro tests to determine toxicity. They studied 43 samples from what's commercially available on the market. Some were consumer products, mostly food and drink related, so drinking cups, disposable trays, coffee capsules, that sort of thing. Other samples were raw materials, meaning plastic pellets or bars. All of the samples were bioplastics, as you said. That's a slightly nebulous term. But in their paper, the scientists define four categories. Those are bio-based, biodegradable plastics, such as polylactic acid or polyhydroxyalkanoate, petroleum-based biodegradable plastics, such as polybutylene succinate or polybutylene adipate terephthalate, non-biodegradable plastics, such as polyethylene or polyethylene terephthalate, and plant-based materials, such as starch, cellulose, or bamboo.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. So, what did the researchers find?
Broadly, they found that these substances were, quote, just as toxic as conventional plastics. However, there was at least one important caveat, which I'll get to in a moment. First, however, the numbers. 67% of the samples had baseline toxicity, 42% induced oxidative stress, and 23% caused antiandrogenicity, which is a type of endocrine disruption. And what the researchers concluded was that, quote, a comparison with conventional plastics indicates that bioplastics and plant-based materials are similarly toxic. This highlights the need to focus more on aspects of chemical safety when designing truly better plastic alternatives. Now, that caveat, they extracted compounds using solvents rather than materials that simulate real food. The scientists say in their paper, published in Environment International, that follow-up studies on rates of migration are needed to determine whether the compounds would actually move from the substrate into the food. If they wouldn't, there's no exposure and therefore no risk. So this study was about hazard, not risk, and therefore needs to be seen in that context.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. Given the findings of the research, what might the implications be for future policy development in this area?
So in their paper, the scientists, who are led by Lisa Zimmermann at Goethe University, Frankfurt am Main, they say that bioplastics are marketed as more sustainable and benign than conventional plastics, despite little evidence to support this notion. Of course, there may be other very good reasons for preferring bioplastics, bio-based plastics, those made from renewable raw materials such as plants rather than petrochemicals, may be more sustainable. Also, biodegradable plastics may limit the long-term harm caused by plastics pollution. What this research emphasizes is that they may not provide any benefits in terms of human health hazard. And this means there are no easy answers to the question of what's a better plastic. It may depend on what your priorities are. Some plastics may be better in one way, while others are better in another. So policymakers have a challenge ahead of them. It's a very topical challenge because we know that governments are very animated about plastics at the moment, particularly in the EU. And in certain discussions at the moment, bioplastics feature quite large. For example, under the EU Circular Economy Action Plan, the European Commission is committed to addressing, quote, emerging sustainability challenges by developing a policy framework for bio-based plastics and biodegradable or compostable plastics by 2021.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. So let's turn now to the legal challenge that has been launched against ECHA by the company at the centre of two landmark cases on animal testing of cosmetic ingredients, and that company is Symrise. Now, those landmark cases concluded back in August when ECHA's Board of Appeal adopted two decisions finding that REACH registrants are not automatically covered by animal testing exemptions just because their substance is an ingredient used solely in cosmetics. The decisions were a blow to animal welfare groups and cosmetic ingredients producers, which had hoped the board would find that substances made exclusively for the cosmetics industry would not require any animal testing. Instead, the decisions issued on the 18th of August, in response to two appeals by Symrise, stated that the REACH regulation may require registrants to perform studies on vertebrate animals, even if the substance is used exclusively as an ingredient in cosmetic products. The marketing ban on animal-tested products under the cosmetics regulation, they say, will not be triggered by conducting animal testing to fulfil REACH requirements, as the data will not need to be relied on to demonstrate the safety of a cosmetic product. So, Catherine, can you tell us more about the decisions that were taken back in August by the ECHA Board of Appeal and the arguments that were put forward by Symrise at the time?
Hi, Kate. Well, it's important to remember that the Board of Appeal's findings were consistent with their previous interpretation of that relationship between REACH and the cosmetics regulation as it relates to animal testing of cosmetics products. So ECHA and the Commission have always stuck to the argument that cosmetics ingredients can require animal testing if the tests are to satisfy REACH requirements. They said this in a joint statement in 2014 and a decision by the European Ombudsman found the same in 2017. And it's the same argument with these decisions. Back in August, the board found that the cosmetics regulation includes human health impacts, but that it doesn't cover other endpoints like worker exposure or environmental effects, and that animal tests or acceptable alternatives are necessary for these endpoints. As the cosmetics regulation includes a marketing ban for products which have been tested on animals, Symrise has argued that conducting the requested animal tests on the two ingredients would trigger the marketing ban for their products. But the board argued that this wasn't the case in their decision, as they said the data, quote, will not need to be relied on for product assessment under the cosmetics regulation, and that the cosmetics regulation's animal testing ban applies to products, not ingredients. So tests on individual ingredients to satisfy REACH endpoints wouldn't trigger the marketing ban.
Thanks, Catherine. So what was the reaction from cosmetic companies and NGOs to the decisions taken by the board back in August?
Well, animal rights NGOs were and are extremely critical of ECHA's decisions. At the time, representatives from Cruelty Free International and PETA both argued that the decisions are undermining the animal testing ban under the cosmetics regulation and that they would result in many more animal tests in the EU. And it's a rare occasion where the NGOs and industry are united in their aims, as the cosmetics industry is also opposed to animal testing in cosmetic products. Last week, the Animal Free Safety Assessment Collaboration, or AFSA, a coalition of cosmetics companies which includes L'Oreal, Procter & Gamble, Avon, Unilever, and the animal rights NGO, the Humane Society International, they released a statement criticizing the two Board of Appeal decisions. And that statement accused ECHA of, quote, systematically requesting unnecessary animal data for cosmetics ingredients, despite a legal obligation to promote non-animal methods. It also called on the EU institutions to protect the ban on animal testing in cosmetics and to formalise a process of animal-free occupational safety assessment.
Thanks, Catherine. So how significant could this new legal challenge be?
Well, for now, it's difficult to speculate because all we know is that Symrise's lawyers have submitted two actions for annulment for the decisions at the EU's General Court. We'll have to wait to see the summary of pleas once they're published in the court's official journal, and the overall proceedings could take up to 2 years. What we do know is that this is a landmark case about how the relationship between REACH and the cosmetics regulation is interpreted on the subject of animal testing on ingredients used solely in cosmetics. If the court rules in Symrise's favour, the board's decisions could be voided and ECHA could have to pay compensation to Symrise. But on a larger scale, it would be a win for the NGOs and industry bodies who've opposed animal testing on substances used solely as cosmetics ingredients. But again, it's important to remember that the EU institutions have been consistent in their interpretation of the relationship between the two regulations for several years now, and that the court's ruling may well be in line with that interpretation in the end.
Okay, thanks very much, Catherine. So finally, let's turn to the US. We heard in last week's special podcast on the US election that the US EPA under a Biden presidency could adopt a broader approach towards TSCA risk evaluations than the current administration. Now, the agency could also increase its scrutiny of new chemical reviews and order more companies to provide chemical data or conduct testing. Now, Eric Baptist, a partner with Wiley Rain and one of our podcast panelists, said he expected significant changes both in the review and approval of new chemicals and also with regard to how the EPA approaches its risk evaluations for existing chemicals. Since then, the transition team for the incoming president and vice president has announced the formation of a 12-member group tasked with evaluating the EPA's operations before the new administration takes over on the 20th of January. So, Terry, first of all, can you tell us a little about the presidential transition and the EPA review team that President-elect Biden announced last week?
Hi, Kate. Sure. Well, the presidential transition basically is the time between the election and when the president is sworn into office on the 20th of January. The transition teams that you had talked about, they lay the groundwork for the incoming administration to take over. So they have a governing agenda when they come in. And you've already seen the Biden-Harris team lay out its four main priorities, which are addressing the COVID-19 pandemic, the economy, racial equity, and climate change. The transition team between the election and inauguration also generally has what are called landing teams or beachhead teams. And those groups meet with current agency officials and staff to figure out where things stand on actions that the current administration has taken, and then what policies or practices the new administration might want to keep and what they might want to change. And many, though not necessarily all, of the people on these landing teams also end up working in the agency that they're reviewing. And as you had mentioned, Kate, the Biden-Harris transition team last week announced a series of these agency review teams, including a 12-member team for the EPA. The EPA review team includes a number of former EPA officials, many with experience on climate change, energy, clean air issues, and that certainly aligns with the incoming president's primary environmental goal to address climate change. But the EPA team also includes a fair number of members with a background working on environmental justice issues or the fair treatment for everyone with regard to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws. And part of the idea here is that environmental burdens shouldn't fall disproportionately on certain communities or groups of people. And the EPA review team lead, Patrice Sims, for example, he's an environmental attorney with Earth Justice, and he helps lead that NGO's Health Communities group. Now, for TSCA, this focus on environmental justice could signal that the EPA will more closely look at how conditions of use of a substance might affect vulnerable subpopulations, be it workers with a greater risk of exposure, or populations that live near facilities where chemicals are being used or manufactured. These are so-called fence line communities. And during the presidential campaign, Joe Biden said that he would push for monitoring of pollutants, including toxics, in these frontline and fence line communities. A couple of the EPA review team members also have a background in hazardous waste cleanup, and that could signal that the administration is serious about addressing PFAS contamination, another issue that the president-elect talked about during the campaign.
Thanks, Terry. So we've heard about the Trump administration's refusal to recognize President-elect Biden's victory. So what does this mean for the transition process?
Sure. Well, typically the transition has been a two-way street. After the election results are clear, one party usually concedes, and then the U.S. General Services Administration, a federal agency, then recognizes or what's called ascertains the apparent winner. And there's a federal law, the Presidential Transition Act, that lays out the process and what the GSA should do at that point. The ascertainment by the GSA frees up federal funding and office space for these review teams or landing teams to do their work. And it also gives the green light to current agency officials and senior staff to meet with the transition team and update them, including preparing transition documents that spell out everything the current administration and federal agencies like the EPA have been working on. The GSA also is supposed to help ensure that the incoming landing teams are cleared to enter the agencies they'll be working for come January 20th. So they have all the clearances and everything just to get into the building. And officials that I've talked to who helped with the Obama administration's transition, they have talked about how helpful the Bush administration was in providing that information, providing those briefings and other resources ahead of President Obama's inauguration. Now, that process, of course, hasn't yet happened this time around. The GSA has thus far said it won't ascertain the winner until the election results become clear. And so far, it's not clear what that means or when exactly that might be. Will the GSA wait until all the states certify their election results? If so, that could be a couple more weeks. States in the U.S. each have different deadlines for when they certify their results. Georgia, for example, which is conducting a hand recount of all their ballots, has until this Friday, November 20th, to certify who won that state and its 16 electoral votes. A total of 270 electoral votes are needed to win the presidency. Pennsylvania and Michigan, they don't certify their results until next Monday, the 23rd. And other swing states like Arizona and Wisconsin don't certify until November 30th or December 1st, respectively. And in the end, all states then have to certify their elections by the 14th of December. And that's when Electoral College members from each state meet to officially cast their electoral ballots for the president. And if things are delayed that long, it could really hurt the incoming Biden administration's efforts to hit the ground running in January. The Biden transition team says their agency teams will start meeting with former agency officials, as well as trade associations, NGOs, and think tanks. But the review teams haven't yet met with current agency officials or senior staff. And there have been many news reports on how this could hamper national security and public health efforts, like distributing a vaccine, for example. But it also puts the incoming administration behind the eight ball across so many different policy areas. Just on chemicals, the current EPA has said that over the next few weeks, it plans to release guidance on PFAS in surface coatings of imported articles. It has a proposed TSCA fees rule coming out, a final rule on science transparency, final rules on 5 persistent bioaccumulative and toxic substances, and it plans to finish all of its TSCA risk reviews of all 10 of those first 10 substances it's reviewing, all by the end of the year. As of Monday of this week, it's only finalized 4 of those. So there's a lot going on at the EPA right now. And the longer it takes for the incoming administration to understand where things stand on all those items, the longer it will take for the incoming Biden administration to prioritize its own actions going forward.
Okay, thank you, Terry. Once the new administration does take over, what are their likely top priorities on TSCA and chemicals?
Yeah, great question. Well, first, anything that's not final, the incoming administration could revise or even just ignore it. Something like the TSCA fees rule, which will at best only have been proposed by January 20th, a newly led EPA could take another look at that and potentially propose different changes. For those final TSCA risk evaluations, which technically are not considered final agency action, at least for uses of chemicals that present an unreasonable risk, you could see the new administration, decide to redo some or all of those risk evaluations, and in doing so, take a more expansive view on aggregate exposures of chemicals, the impacts on vulnerable populations, or those fence line communities that we had talked about. It could also mean looking at additional conditions of use of substances, including uses regulated by other statutes, like the Clean Air Act or the Safe Drinking Water Act, which the current EPA has essentially excluded from their risk evaluations. And for those next 20 existing chemicals to be reviewed, and also for new chemical reviews, many expect to see more scrutiny from the EPA under a new Biden administration. And that could mean more orders from the agency seeking chemical data or requiring testing. And in particular, for the new chemical review process and pre-manufacturer notices for new chemicals, both the current EPA and industry are kind of frustrated with how often submissions have to be reworked or need additional information. So that's certainly an area where all sides would like to see changes. Now, with those rules that are final, if the agency did want to make changes, they would have to propose new revisions and basically go through that rulemaking process again. And that would take a little bit longer. Things that fall into this category would be the science transparency rule, if it is finalized, as the agency says it will be in the next few weeks. Those 5 PBT rules that I mentioned, and even a recently finalized rule governing agency guidance documents. Now, a lot will depend on the new EPA leadership that the Biden administration brings in, and that can take time. Even with a quick appointment and confirmation of a new EPA administrator, that could still take a number of weeks. And with the assistant administrator levels, including the official who would direct the EPA's chemicals office, filling those roles can take longer, up to several months. So beyond the really big ticket items that we've heard about, like rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, we're likely to see a delay in a lot of current EPA actions while the new administration assesses where things are and sets its new priorities. And that sort of pause or delay could be a little longer too if the transition process continues to be a one-sided affair.
Okay, thanks very much, Terry. So that brings us to the end of today's episode. So thank you again to Terry, Catherine, and Andrew for sharing their insight into today's stories with us. And thank you to you, our audience, for listening to today's episode, and we hope you found it valuable. If you would like to find out more about the topics from today's discussion, please head over to the Chemical Watch website at chemicalwatch.com. We look forward to seeing you again next week. Until then, goodbye.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch. Intelligence to transform product safety.
The Chemical Watch Podcast.